And it's truly a privilege for me to honor her and welcome her to the stage. Please help me do so.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate the invitation to come to Nebraska. I think my graduate student who's from Nebraska is very jealous of me today. And I guess the only bad part is I have to give a talk to a group of beef producers about alternative meats. And so I was assigned to this topic because there's a lot of buzz around it. I live in Davis, California, about an hour from Silicon Valley, and I first got interested in this topic because I kept having people approaching me about the end of animal agriculture, and I hadn't read the news release about that, and so I wanted to try to understand it. And so I wrote a piece in The Conversation about how cows are getting a bad rap in the cultured meat debate, and I think that's the reason that Carla approached me about speaking on this topic. And it's a really interesting topic. It's very political and in the news at the moment, but what I wanted to do today was try to give you some data on what it is, what it isn't, who the players are, who's investing in it, and basically my talk is going to go through what it is not, then what it is, and who's investing, who's selling, who's buying, how's it regulated, and what are the impacts likely to be to your industry. And I think I'm delighted to see a full room here. It's easy to shrug this stuff off as just annoying garbage, but actually I think let's pay attention, because there's a story out there around cattle production that is missing, and I think we have to learn how to defend the industry against some of the claims that come out from the groups that are proposing this. So what it is not, what I am not talking about today is what I call vegan meat, and that is basically meat made out of plants, and that's an oxymoron right there, but basically it is shaping plants into burgers. And there's been a lot of publicity recently about the two major players in this space, and that is the Impossible Burger. And basically what you have to do there is get a protein source from plants, then add in the ingredients that would be typically found in a burger, and then process it into a patty, and you've got the Beyond Burger or the Impossible Burger. This is different to cultured meat. And so I'm going to play a little video that was put together by what's called the Good Food Institute, New Harvest, which is an investment firm that develops cultured meat or investments into cultured meat. So with any luck, I'm going to play this and you'll be able to hear it.
And it's first harvested in a small and harmless procedure. Next, the tissue is cut into minuscule pieces to separate the muscle fibers and cells. And this is how it looks close up. The muscle tissue consists of fat cells and muscle cells, which are separated to produce cultured beef. By dissecting the muscle cells, individual cells can be removed and cultured. The cells start dividing. Eventually, from one muscle cell, more than 1 trillion cells can be grown. These cells naturally merge to form so-called myotubes, which are no longer than 0.3 millimeters. The myotubes are then placed in a ring around a central hub of gel. Muscles' innate tendency to contract causes them to put on bulk, growing into a small piece of muscle tissue. From one small piece of tissue, this pioneering technique can produce more than a trillion strands. Little pieces of muscle are layered together, we get exactly the same thing we started with, beef.
simple. That's basically the idea. You take a cell from an animal, be it a cow, be it a chicken, be it a pig, put it into a bioreactor, culture it in media, and then differentiate it into protein, fat, put together a burger. That's the idea. I grow cells in my lab. I have a molecular lab, and we do cell culture. And I don't think I'm the most incompetent scientist in the world. We have a heck of a time keeping those cells alive. We have a heck of a time keeping those cells free of bacterial and fungal contamination. What we're talking about here is growing living cells in a bioreactor. And these cells are going to double their weight every day or so often. And that's going to require that they have a media that enables them to do that. And at least in my lab, when I'm growing these types of cells, I need to provide those cells with food, and I need to provide them with what's called fetal bovine serum, which is serum that's taken from actually slaughter calves at a slaughterhouse, because there's unique growth factors in there to enable those cells to differentiate and grow. We also require other serum and also antibiotics in the case of the cells that I'm growing. What these guys are proposing to do is do all of that without growth factors derived from animals and without the use of antibiotics, which is possible, but it's not trivial. And additionally, if you want to provide a product that has the same nutrient requirement or nutrient benefits as animal source foods, then obviously you're going to also have to provide all of the unique nutrients that you get from animal source foods, such as vitamin B and iron and micronutrients and the like. So what started all this? Well, it all started in the Netherlands with a gentleman by the name of Mark Post. And basically back in 2013, so less than a decade ago, he grew a burger in a lab for the cost of around about 250,000 euro, which is a quarter of a million euro. It's about 400,000 or so US dollars. And he was a doctor who worked in tissue differentiation, and it caught his attention that you could potentially use this technology to grow meat in a lab. And as a result of that, he's now put together a team that is developing a company to try to do this. And all of this was originally started by an investment from the co-founder of Google. And you'll notice some really interesting investment dynamics behind this whole cultured meat thing. So this experiment was done in England, and it had a lot of publicity. There was a celebrity chef that cooked the original burger. And it kind of led off to the development of New Harvest, which is this investment group that is now investing in it. However, if you actually look at what Dr. Post said back in 2013, that is, to date, there is no process for proliferating not just muscle cells, but also fat cells, which obviously are an important part of the taste component, which are particularly relevant for taste. It's also not yet possible to produce larger pieces of meat, such as steaks. I challenge that. There is actually a way to do that. It's called a rumen. And it is actually the ability of cows to take in cellulose and produce delicious meat that is basically solar-powered, self-cleaning, solar-driven bioreactor. That is basically what a ruminant is. And that is what these guys have to compete against. That is something that's driven by biology rather than in industry. And the underlying rationale for cultured meat, if you kind of listen to the discussions, is the current meat production and meat consumption is not sustainable. We must find sustainable alternatives to current meat production. Possible alternatives are veganism, vegetarianism, other protein sources such as vegan-based alternatives or insects or cultured meat. However, a global transition to veganism/vegetarianism and other protein sources will not succeed. Cultured meat is more suited to replacing current meat production because it is real meat. Therefore, cultured meat is a sustainable and realistic alternative to today's meat production systems. You may not follow that flow diagram in your brain, but this is the argument that I hear again and again as to why we need alternative meat. And some of the groups that are putting out these types of statements tend to look a lot like this. I've put pictures up because there's a certain similarity to some of the groups that are proposing that this is an alternative meat. And this is an investment report that was put out by a group called A.T. Kearney, who say that novel vegan meat replacements and cultured meat have the potential to disrupt the meat industry, and that by 2040, that's 20 years' time, or 21 and a half, only 40% of global meat consumption will still come from conventional meat sources. I'm going to drill down a little bit on those numbers in a minute, but I want to give you a feel for some of these projections and where a lot of this hype is coming from. Because that's a very bold statement, that in 20 years' time, 60% of all our meat is going to be coming from alternative sources. There's another group called the Rethink Report, and basically it includes these three gentlemen, which if you read their CVs, is very typical. Typically have done some sort of an engineering degree at MIT or the like, and then some sort of a Master's of Business Administration or some sort of computer background. So very techie kind of groups. And these types of groups have made a lot of money off Silicon Valley investments like Uber and Google and the like, which actually don't produce a thing. They produce technology which better uses people's cars. They produce a better search engine, but they don't produce food or a thing. And they're used to having technology be able to replace the current way of doing business. But I think that's a fundamentally different thing to producing food. And according to these rocket scientists, the winners in food production are likely to be biotechnology and software companies, those who have a model where efficient production distribution is key, or those retailers and distributors able to adapt to and help shape the new supply chain. And this particular report had this little graph in it, which basically says that fermentation farms will be the new food forms. There will be job opportunities engineering, designing, building and operating them. So fermentation farms are going to take the place of ranches. And I had a bit of a look at their graph, and being a little bit anal because I'm a scientist, I was like, okay, so by 2030, that's 10 years' time, 70% of all beef will come from quote-unquote modern production methods, which I guess makes it that you're doing old-fashioned, unmodern production methods. But I just drew a little line across there. I'm like, they didn't even do a very good job with their graph. But what was actually more intriguing was that by 2019, last time I checked, that's today, then 10% of all meat is going to come from modern production methods. Okay, I know there's about 14 billion pounds of beef in the US, so that's about 1.4 billion should be coming from modern meat production methods. What does the data say? This is data I got from NCBA, thank you Sarah Place. And basically, if you look at current alternative protein, and particularly beef there, you'll see that alternative beef substitutes are about 0.07 billion pounds, or 0.5% of beef production. And if you do the math on that, that's about 70 million pounds. Or if we want to talk about quarter pounders, because apparently that's the metric that we're discussing in this particular talk, it's about 280 million quarter pounders. Hardly 10% of beef production in the United States. If you compare that to beef, and since we're using the metric of quarter pounders, the remaining 13.93 billion pounds of beef is equivalent to somewhere around about 55,720 million quarter pounders. So at the moment, it's a very small fragment of the industry that we're talking about, and some of these projections are quite frankly unbelievable because it's such a big industry. Although I realize that venture capitalists see a lot of money in it, they also have to actually provide product to replace the product that they're saying they're going to replace. As a result of all of this, there has been a lot of discussion around the fact that growing cells in culture is going to be more environmentally sustainable. That's a lot of the driving force behind this. And so in order to make those statements, we have to look at, well, what is the carbon footprint, the land use and the energy use of different forms of protein production? And the beef industry and animal agriculture in general has done quite a number of studies looking at this. And this little graph that's shown here kind of breaks down beef and chickens and milk and poultry and cultured meat into three different columns there. The carbon footprint per kilogram of product, the land use, and energy use. And what you'll notice right off the bat is that if you go up a trophic level, in other words, if you're eating an animal that eats plants, by definition, you're going to have a higher carbon footprint per kilogram of product. But a kilogram of meat is very different to a kilogram of spinach in terms of the nutritional components that it's providing and what it's actually giving to you. You'll also notice that in general, ruminants have a higher greenhouse gas production per kilogram of unit of product than monogastrics like pigs and chickens. But they're eating very different things. So monogastrics are competing directly for human food, whereas ruminants are out in the range eating inedible cellulose, often on land that has no other human food purpose. And so if you look at the land use for different purposes, then of course cattle and ruminants in general are going to have a bigger land footprint because they're grazing on land that has no other human food purpose and where you typically, it's non-arable land that can't grow crops. And so to me, that metric isn't really comparing apples and apples, but it's the energy use that I think is a really interesting one. Because if you think about it, if you have to grow cells in a culture vat, and you need to provide those cells with food, and you need to change their diapers, so to speak, in other words, get rid of the spent media and clean that vat and ensure that it's free of contaminants, then that's going to increase how much industrial energy or electricity you're going to need to run those systems. And if you look at that, the third column there, where we're comparing beef and in this case cultured meat, there's a lot more industrial energy that's likely to be required for this cultured meat as compared to beef. And I've kind of blown up that table here so we can more directly compare it. And I've given a couple of different estimates there. So on average, beef, maybe the carbon footprint's about 30 CO2 equivalents per kilogram of beef, whereas with cultured meat, you're somewhere, and it depends on the assumptions you make, between 1.69 and 25, and that is going to be very different amounts of protein depending on the assumptions you make. And what you might notice is there's this one cultured meat estimate there that has a really low carbon footprint. It uses almost no land to grow the product, and it uses very little energy relative to the other estimate that has the energy use per kilogram of product as high as 359 millijoules per kilogram of product. And what's interesting is if you look at the author of that one study that has this very, very positive outlook for cultured beef, it's funded by New Harvest, which is the group that came out of that group in the Netherlands. That's the venture capital to try to get people to invest in cultured meat. And some of the assumptions that that researcher made was that you would be able to grow mammalian cells in the same culture media that you can grow yeast. And that is just not true. And so you get a very, very positive outlook there. And a lot of people use this number to say, when we grow cultured beef, we're going to have, you know, 99% less of a footprint than beef. But they're using this this life cycle analysis that was done that isn't at all realistic in terms of what it is, that the second cultured beef example there, which has the much higher range for the amount of industrial energy that's likely to be used in developing of cultured meat, is a lot more realistic. And if you look at the author of that study, as it turned out, she was a science and technology policy fellow with the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and so doesn't really have a dog in this fight. And so at the moment, because no one's actually growing this product, we don't know what the life cycle assessment's going to be, because no one's reduced it to practice. We had that one burger for €250,000, but there's really hasn't been the development of this technology to really be able to make the statements that it's going to be dramatically less or dramatically more electricity, or at least industrial electricity use. For sure, it'll use less land, but what land is it using? It's using typically land to grow arable crops, which doesn't, it's not the land that's being used for ruminants. And so in general, you know, I think if you look at the industrial energy and the global warming or greenhouse gas emissions per unit of product, we can say that there are more greenhouse gas emissions for a ruminant than there are for monogastrics, but that's because they're digesting inedible cellulose. The monogastrics are competing directly for food with humans. And when we're looking at the energy use for industrial meat production or cell culture, we're going to have quite high levels of energy. And if that energy is coming from a source other than solar or wind power, obviously that's going to require the burning of fossil fuels, which may have the same kind of implications that it has when we're raising conventional beef. And so I think a lot of the benefits are really based on anticipatory life cycle analyses that haven't yet been reduced to practice. The other interesting thing is that all of these numbers are based on a kilogram of product. And a kilogram of product doesn't say anything about the composition, the nutrient composition of that product. Is it nutritionally equivalent? Because really, until that's true, you really can't do an apples and apples comparison. And interestingly, the metric that we're using is quarter pounders of ground beef, which is kind of a strange metric to use when you look at a cow when she's broken down, or he. You know, a 1,300-pound animal will produce about 639 pounds of edible beef. About 62% of that is something other than ground beef. And so to kind of reduce a cow to ground beef and ignore also the 11% of the value of the carcass that comes from everything else that's used, the hide, the blood, everything but the moo, is really using the wrong denominator, I think. And it doesn't value the role that those animals have played in agricultural ecosystems and their important role in basically grazing inedible cellulose. However, this story has been a very big seller, and there is a lot of money that's going into venture capital for either the vegan burgers shown on the bottom there. There's been about $900 million in capital, venture capital gone in there, or the cell culture base, which is still, it's interesting, which is still an emerging product that's coming along and has had less venture capital. Sorry about that. Let's see if we can keep on going. So there's been a lot more investment so far into the vegan burgers, the Impossible burgers, the Beyond burgers, than there has been for the cultured meat, in part because that's a fairly new topic. And according to the Good Food Institute, which is another one of those interestingly named groups, so they are laser-focused on using markets and food technology to transform our food system away from factory-farmed animal products and towards clean meat and plant-based alternatives. They're a group out of California, as you might have guessed. And basically, they're suggesting that in the 5 years leading up to 2018, there's been about $17.1 billion invested in vegan replacement products, including the acquisition of White Wave by Danone. And there's been about $73.3 million invested in the cell-based meat companies. So this is a really interesting slide of who's doing the investing. And so We have an interesting group here. So Bill Gates, and their net worth is following their name. So he's $105 billion worth. Richard Branson, who owns Virgin Airlines, which is kind of an interesting one. So he's concerned about greenhouse gas emissions of cattle, but not aeroplanes, apparently. Lash Kashing, who's, a billionaire in Asia. Leonardo DiCaprio, who you probably know is an actor, and it shows that acting doesn't pay as well as being the developer of Microsoft. And then Sergey Brin, who was the co-founder of Google. Henry Soesto, who is an Asian multi-millionaire or multi-billionaire, but I couldn't find his net worth. And then a bunch of companies, that some of which will look familiar to you, where there's been investments from some of these different companies to basically develop these technologies in addition to their animal protein investments. So according, again, to this A.T. Kearney report, novel vegan meat replacements will disrupt the meat industry. And I mentioned before, in their estimate, in 20 years' time, only 40% of global meat will come from conventional meat sources. And they say cultured meat will win in the long run, but that this vegan meat replacements is kind of a transition phase. So the Impossible Burger and the Beyond Burger are this transition phase. And then they have this really interesting graph that basically shows their projections, where conventional meat will be 40% of meat production in 2030, whereas vegan burgers will be about 25% and cultured meat 35%. So I said, okay, what does the FAO say will be meat production by 2040? And so basically summarized on this slide is what meat production looks like in 2040. Just to remind you that milk is by far the largest animal source protein, and little known fact is that fish are actually, in terms of meat, the next most common source. But if I just take terrestrial-based meat, that is chickens, pigs, and cows, in 2040, of the 151 million metric tons that will be produced, there's about 402 million metric tons that will come from beef, pigs, and chicken. So if their estimate is correct, by 2040, how many quarter pounders are going to need to be produced by vegan-based alternatives to get to that 25% of all meat production, and by cultured meat to get to that 35% of all meat production? And these are the kind of numbers that we're talking about. So for the plant-based quarter pounders, we're up in the 886 billion quarter pounders. And for the cultured meat, we get into the somewhat ridiculous 1,240,761,529,514 quarter pounders from an industry that as of yet has not produced one. Why are we not laughing at these projections? Why is this not getting called out by anybody that understands the basics of this? It's just kind of perplexing to me. So these are all the different companies, and this is in your handout, that are proposing to produce cultured meat. And it's not just cultured beef, it's cultured chicken, it's cultured eggs, it's cultured milk, it's cultured ice cream, it's cultured leather. And this particular company called Future Meat Technologies is an Israeli company. And they, just a month ago, announced they're going to build the first lab-grown meat production facility. They better get on that, because they've got to get, what, 1 trillion in 20 years? But anyway, so they're going to establish the first cultured meat pilot production facility producing non-GMO, you can imagine what that did to me when I saw that particular statement, cultivated directly from animal cells at a commercial scale. And they plan to establish the facility in Tel Aviv, and they've secured $14 million in Series A round funding. The company says its lab-based manufacturing model will result, here we go, 99% less land and 80% fewer greenhouse gas emissions. I don't know how they get their electricity in Jerusalem, but I kind of doubt that. The company plans to introduce hybrid products into the market, combining plant proteins with for texture in with the cultured beef. And the costs at the moment are $150 per pound for chicken and $200 per pound for beef, but they aim to be cost competitive with beef by next year, or 2021, sorry, the year after next. So good luck with that. The company's manufacturing process, during which fibroblast cells will double in mass every 24 hours. I'm telling you, I do this for a living. That is going to be incredibly, incredibly hard. There's no way on earth we could even think about doing that in my lab. And the funding for this group is coming from Chicago-based venture capitalists, Swiss-based venture capitalist, and the CEO of a Philippine-based venture capitalist who was shown on that slide earlier, the one whose amount of money we don't know, Henry Siesto. With this investment, we're thrilled to bring cultured meat from the lab to the factory floor and begin working with our industrial partners to bring our product to market. This is kind of the opposite of biology and biotic development of food. It is actually the industrialization of food production. It is literally the definition of a factory farm to me. It actually is a factory. And I had to put this in because I just think this is the most amusing slide I've ever seen. So I was reading some of these stories, and there's a group that's trying to produce culture-based leather. So it's actually protein-based leather. And they had this little setup in a museum or an art display in a museum in, I believe it was in Japan. And what you can see in that kind of circular bubble is a little tiny coat with little arms on either side. And this is produced by, the display is called Victimless Leather. And the artists wanted to show how you could grow leather in this little bubble. But what was interesting is over the course of the exhibit, and I've never laughed reading a scientific paper before, but this is what it actually read. One of the manifestations was the cultured miniature leather jacket. Over the course of the exhibit, it became infected with a fungus, and it gradually worsened, growing in the jacket's left armpit. By the exhibit's end, multiple small growths had formed on the jacket's surface, protruding to and adding to the dimension. And you can kind of see, if you can kind of imagine, a little orange jacket in the middle there, and there's this great big growth in the armpit of that jacket. So it's not going to be trivial to keep these systems free of contaminants, because bacteria are going to see these nutrients that are just sitting there without an immune system to protect them. So that's kind of what a cow does, right? She makes sure that the bacteria don't eat the good nutrients. So who's buying this product? Nobody yet, because there's nothing for sale. So this is still anticipatory at this stage. However, there's still money to be made, at least for the vegan burger guys. And I want to just talk about the fact that Beyond Meat, so the Beyond Meat and Impossible Burger are both vegan burger companies. And Beyond Meat went public this year. In other words, it did a stock offering. And it's done a first stock offering, and then the price took off. And then it did a second stock offering. And during the second stock offering, you can sell the shares you bought at the original stock offering. And what's interesting is that there's been this big increase in price, and both the CEO and the chief financial officer of Beyond Meat have sold something like, I don't know, 40 million shares or 55 million shares, such that over the course of those 3 months, they're going to net somewhere between $8 million and $12 million from the run-up in the value of that company's stock. There's nothing illegal about this, but it is a very pretty cool way to make $12 million in 3 months. And similarly, Impossible Foods has been valued at about $2 billion. And it's kind of interesting looking at the founder of these two companies, because they're both, their last names are Brown. What are the chances of that? So we've got Ethan Brown, who's an LA-based vegan, and we've got Pat Brown, who's a San Francisco area-based vegan. So I'm from California, sorry about that. But what you see is they put together a group of are very idealistic people who honestly believe that what they're doing is very important to the future of the planet. And particularly Pat Brown has repeatedly said that he's going to get rid of all animal agriculture globally by 2035. And you know what I did when he did that math. I kind of did the math on, well, how many impossible burgers would that be every year if we're not only talking about land-based terrestrial animals, but also milk and fish and all the rest of it. And it's something like, I don't remember the exact number, 14.8 quadrillion. And quadrillion's above trillion. It's actually higher than the US debt in burgers every year. That's pretty impressive. And to me, it just kind of demonstrates that these people are very smart people, they're very passionate people, but they haven't taken the time to step back and understand food production and agriculture and the important role that animal agriculture plays in the life of the 1.3 billion people that depend on those animals, and also the importance of ruminants in production systems. How's it currently regulated? FDA oversees cell collection, the cell banks, the cell growth and differentiation, and then it's going to transition from FDA to USDA at the cell harvest stage, which is kind of, I guess, kind of analogous to the meat processing plant, for want of a better expression. And then they will, USDA will oversee the production and labeling of the food products. FDA also has legal standards on what different foods can be called, and specifically ice cream has to contain no less than 10% milk fat. And there is a cultured ice cream company called Perfect Day. And so as a result of the fact that all of their fat comes from coconut oil and sunflower oil, they have to be a frozen dairy dessert. They're not allowed to be called ice cream. And again, we see the Perfect Day co-founders, Berkeley-based here, and they're basically going to produce vegan dairy products. And they've also raised $24 million in Series A funding round. What I think was perhaps the most ironic thing I've ever read in a piece of literature, I'm not sure literature is probably a bit grand for this particular document. So we're back to the Rethink X, and what they're saying here is, what is going to be the impact of cultured meat on land use in this case? And what we see here is we've got basically cattle feed for cropland is the bottom there, and it's getting smaller over time. Then cattle pasture and rangeland is going down, and then other livestock land use is going down, and then you see modern foods land requirement, and by that they mean cultured meat, is going to go up a little bit. But they say that by 2030, just again 10 years time, cattle, pasture, rangeland and feed crop land will decline by about 50%. This means the disruption of the US beef and dairy industries by modern production methods will free up about 300 million acres of land by 2030, rising to 450 million acres by 2035. Free up. Okay, so what do they propose might happen to that land, which I kind of think might be your land, but I could be wrong. This is actually what's in the document. According to them, the best proxy for that land that has no alternative productive use might be ranch land. Yep. That's what it says. So I want to just segue to say, you know what? We're not doing a good job telling our story if that's what those rocket scientists came up with, because that actually is the best use of that land. That's why it's ranch land. And the fact that the secret magic potion of ruminants is their ability to turn that land that has no other arable use into high-quality human food. And I think if we look at this graph and look at the two grasslands that have no human, that have no arable land, that is where the cows are. And this is the global distribution of cattle. And you can see there, and I think this is well known to most, is that there's a very high concentration of cattle, particularly in India and East African highlands, also in Northern Europe and South America. And there are very few in desert areas and tropical rainforests of the Amazon and the Congo Basin. But I think as importantly is the fact that when we're talking about U.S. agriculture, we have somewhere around about 90 million head of cattle, and that's shown on this graph in the blue, and that goes to the left-hand axis, versus production, which goes to the right-hand axis, shown in red. And what that shows is that the 90 million cattle in the U.S. are producing the most beef of anywhere on Earth, and that there's very large discrepancies depending upon the productivity of the production system as to the pounds of beef per head on the ground. And what particularly sticks out in this particular graph is obviously India, with by far the largest cattle population on Earth, with very little beef production. That has nothing to do with science or production systems, but it's religious prohibition on the consumption of meat, and it's or beef specifically. And it's interesting to me that no one really ever talks about that. And so there's a lot of focus given to what I would say the fairly productive cows in the US with the most productive system to produce beef, and yet everybody kind of gives a free pass to the over 300 million animals that exist in India. And if we look globally, as it relates to the greenhouse gas emissions of agriculture, agriculture as a global sector is around about 24%, of which livestock is about 14.5% of greenhouse gas emissions globally. And of that, beef is around about 5%, dairy is about 2%. In general, ruminants are about 10% of that. And I think that number is an important number to think about in a global perspective, because by far the most emissions are coming particularly from the burning of fossil fuels. And if we look specifically at the US, we have about 9% of our greenhouse gas emissions coming from agriculture. And when you break down where most of our emissions are coming from, it's coming from the production of electricity and industry. And if we're proposing to take our animals out of the system and replace it with industrial, basically factory farming using energy or electricity, are we actually going the right way if our concern is trying to reduce the environmental footprint of our food production? If we look specifically at cattle, we're around about 4% of the US greenhouse gas emissions of that agriculture being 9. Livestock are a little less than 4%. Replacing all livestock in the United States would reduce, or getting rid of them and then everybody going vegan, would reduce our environment or our greenhouse gas emissions about 2.6%, but we'd be left with a fairly big deficit in terms of nutrients that are provided by animal source proteins that we really won't have a good replacement for if we were to take all animal source foods out of our diet. And I think that although Patrick Brown says that cows haven't improved at all, they're an old-fashioned technology, I think if you look at our production systems in the US, and this is the dairy, which went from 26 million cows in 1944 to 9 million today, but doubled the milk produced by those cows. And if you look at the system today, each cow is producing about a little over fourfold what she did in 1944. And that's being done with, and so the milk today is produced on less land, using less animals, producing less manure, producing less greenhouse gases, to such that a glass of milk today has about a third of the carbon footprint that a glass of milk in 1944 had. And I think we can see a similar pattern for cattle, and there was some mention earlier about improved genetics, and geneticists can take some credit for this, but also better feed, better veterinary care. Our numbers in blue have been going down since around about 1970s, but production in beef has been going up. The only way that can happen is if you're getting more beef per cow. And I think that as a result, is really improving the environmental footprint of our beef production. And inefficient production systems are the main cause of very high greenhouse gas emissions per unit of output. And really, the big opportunities here are in the developing world, where most of the demand for animal source protein is going to be coming in the next 20 years. And that is where I believe we should be focusing all of this investment money, on trying to improve the efficiencies of our production systems rather than replace it within an industrial system growing cells in a culture vat. And I'll just finish with this slide, which is a kind of an interesting slide that shows the input emissions per calorie from some common US dairy items. And so the red is showing energy use, the blue is showing water footprint, and the grey, or the third, is greenhouse gas emissions. And what you notice here is that fresh fruits and vegetables have a fairly high energy use, because you've got to keep them cold to get them to market. Of course, products like beef have a high greenhouse gas emissions. Yes, that's because they're digesting cellulose, and methane is a natural byproduct of that. But if you really wanted to go to a very, very low environmental footprint diet, you know which products you would eat a lot of? You would eat a lot of added sugars, solid fats, and oils. And I don't think you'll find too many doctors on earth that would advise you to move to that diet. Yes, it might be good for the earth, but it would not be good for your physical health. And so these questions around the sustainability of our food production systems are so complex, because there's so many different metrics that have to be considered. And I think that to allow the narrative to be that cattle have to be replaced by a cell culture vat in an industrial factory is almost insane. And if we look at the importance of animal production to the US industry, I think that that really is something that is not present in these discussions, because we're talking about replacing 40% of the value of the global agricultural output of the global food system. In America alone, animal production is a really critical component of the US economy, with 1 million farms producing $182 billion in products in 2011. And it's also a really big employer, and also produces a whole bunch of not only revenue, but also tax income, and in both property taxes and income taxes. And so I guess I don't like the dichotomous framing that's being proposed by some of the groups that are really pushing these cultured meat. I think growing animal cells efficiently and keeping contaminants out of the system and end product is really hard. It requires energy, attentive management, and innovation. Whether the meat is produced in a natural biological system, also known as cattle ranching, where you're basically powered by solar energy and the physiology of a ruminant, or you're in an industrial system using electricity and a bioreactor to produce cultured product in a fermentation factory. They're both hard, and I think that they both have a place, and this dichotomous framing of we need to get rid of all animal agriculture is quite frankly a little bit ludicrous when you look at the important role it plays in the economy, in the environment, and more generally in feeding the population of Earth. Thank you.